You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right On Radio, Dave Fettig will be talking with Kathleen West, the author of Are We There Yet?, her second novel. She's a veteran teacher with a degree in English from McAllister College and a master's in literacy education from the University of Minnesota. She lives in Minneapolis with her A-plus family, her wonderful golden doodle, but her B-minus dogs.
And I'm Annie Harview. Also on tonight's show, Liz Olds talks with John Brandon, the author of Ivory Shoals. Rich in deadpan humor, as well as visceral details that illuminate a diverse cast of characters, Ivory Shoals uncovers deep truths about family and self-determination as the reader tracks Gussie's dangerous odyssey out of childhood. Brandon teaches at Hamline University here in Minnesota. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Thank you. And I'm Dave, and I'm here with Kathleen West. Welcome, Kathleen, to the studios.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be talking into a real radio microphone.
And we're delighted to have you. It's great. So let's start, Kathleen, by having you set up the novel. Give us an overview of what it's about. We are talking about Are We There Yet? And then set up your reading for us, please.
Sure. Are We There Yet? Is about Alice Sullivan, who is a late 30s mom who feels like she's finally getting her life back because her youngest child is in the second grade. So she's feeling pretty great about herself until one morning she goes to her second grader's parent-teacher conference and learns that she's about 8 levels behind in reading. And then from there is summoned to the middle school to hear about her son Teddy's disturbing bullying type behaviors. And this has these new like problems, especially her son, create ripple effects in her friend group and in the community, her reputation, etc.
And we'll talk more about that. Yeah. So what's our reading tonight?
Oh, our reading is right when she gets to that assistant principal's office to talk about her son's bad behavior. And I'll just give a little hint of how clueless she is about it. And I might interrupt myself if there's something confusing. Mrs. Sullivan, he wrinkled his nose, why don't you and I talk first? Alice tugged at the end of her scarf and wished again that Patrick could be here. She glanced back at Teddy, wary, as she followed the administrator into his brightly lit office. The placard on his desk read, Jason Whitaker. Before she was ready, her left arm only halfway out of her jacket, he launched in. As you may know, Mrs. Sullivan, it's been a difficult start to seventh grade for Teddy. Difficult start? Alice pulled her arms free and shoved the down-filled jacket behind her. She blinked at the smaller letters engraved on the nameplate, Assistant Principal. Is this about the midterm comment from the band teacher? Jason clicked his mouse and read off his monitor. This is actually my third interaction with your son. His third disciplinary infraction, he clarified, in the last 4 weeks. The note Alice had written herself at Adrian's conference just 15 minutes before flashed into her consciousness. Level E, she'd scrawled, fear and embarrassment seizing her. And now there were 3 disciplinary infractions at middle school, and there'd been that aggressive text, too. Alice blinked rapidly and hot tears welled. Mr. Whitaker pushed a box of Kleenex toward her without making eye contact. I had no idea, she said, her voice breathy. Don't you check the portal? Portal? Alice felt like a malfunctioning robot. All she could do was inanely repeat his words. Meredith had mentioned the portal, but Alice had chalked her friend's vigilance up to overprotectiveness. After all, Meredith had cut Sadie's grapes in half until she was in second grade. She religiously read teachers' Friday newsletters top to bottom. Alice and Nadia lightly mocked these behaviors. Skimming those weekly newsletters, after all, had always served Alice just fine. Teddy's always been a great student, always A's and B's, she said now. I haven't really had to track his homework. Jason rubbed his chin. Well, he said, sometimes things look smooth on the outside, but there's a lot happening under the surface. That might be true for other kids, Alice thought, but not for Teddy. He'd always been completely transparent. Guileless, her mother had said more than once. As Alice's mom had a PhD in child psychology, Alice trusted her implicitly. He's never had any behavioral problems before, Alice insisted.
Foreshadowing. So thank you for that. That was Kathleen West reading from Are We There Yet?, her latest novel. So Kathleen, people talk about ripped from the headline stories.
Oh, yeah.
This, for me, felt like a rip from the neighborhood story or soccer field story, if you will. It really comes from the gut and contemporary American family life. Where did these storylines and these characters come from?
Well, I have to say that I've been a teacher for 20 years. So a lot of my stories kind of spring from life in the classroom or just the privilege of knowing multiple families and thinking about all of the challenges that they faced and that I've helped them walk through over the years. And this particular story isn't based on any one kid or family, but I imagine a lot of problems for other people. And I myself am the mom of two teenagers, so I kind of think of the worst case scenario that could happen in my house and then give it a what if.
Yeah, and you paint a very realistic worst-case scenario. And I'm so glad that my kids grew up a little bit too late for the phones. Let's talk about what drives the narrative here. Well, where the problems come from for these kids and their parents?
Well, social media plays a huge role in the problems that the kids get into in this story. But it's not just like a social media is terrible story, because that's not actually what I believe about social media. And even if I did, I'm not sure how realistic it is to be raising a kid right now and expect that they not have a phone.
Correct. Absolutely.
I think the problem is when you're using your phone and you have access to instant communication and all kinds of apps, et cetera, is that when you're angry or sad or frustrated, it's easy to act impulsively and not think through the potential consequences of your behavior. And I think that's what's going on here. And actually, I wanted to play with the idea that a lot of the problems, especially for Sadie, she's another of the middle school characters, her biggest trouble that she gets into kind of happens because her mom has a very strict rule about a phone cutoff time.
Yeah.
Her mom turns off her apps at 9 p.m. Like, there's as a parent, you can have an app that lets you control your kids' access to certain things. And her mom shuts her phone off at 9 p.m. And a kid asks her for a photo at like 8:57.
Yeah.
And so she doesn't have a long time to think about whether or not she wants to do that before that cutoff. So I really liked the idea of playing with this idea of the mom's trying to keep her safe, and that policy that's designed to keep her safe actually is what gets her in trouble.
These are very complex characters. There are moments when, as a reader, we feel like, okay, we're supposed to not like this kid, or we're supposed to love this kid. And then a chapter or two later, the whole thing's flipped on us. And it's a page turner. I want to mention that right now. It's an American domestic sort of novel, and it's a page turner. You just want to know what happens next to these kids. And I want to talk about how you set that up. But before we do, you mentioned Alice, and we had that reading. This is in large part a book about what is family for me too. I mean, she has a very complex family. You want to describe that for our listeners, please?
Sure.
What she's
As an added complexity for Alice, she finds out a big family secret right at the beginning of the book when her kids are having such a hard time. And that's that her mom had a baby when she was 19 that she placed for adoption and now has reunited with that woman who she really desperately wants to integrate into their family. Mm-hmm. So Alice has to kind of think about her role as being a daughter and the ways that she's relied on her mom throughout her life and what they might owe each other at this point in her life. And of course, the new daughter, Adrian, who comes into their family, is perfect in every way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. So, and she's like a child psychologist herself, and the mom is a child psychologist. Like, so Alice feels really on the outside.
And Alice is an interior designer, and I loved the metaphor, certainly intentional, of how perfect she could make interiors, other people's interiors, and her own interior home while she was an absolute wreck inside herself. It's a beautiful metaphor.
Thank you for noticing that.
Hey.
I had a
English
really fun
majors unite.
I had a really fun time playing with that. And I also had a fun time playing with the idea that her mom, who's more of like an earth mother, hippie kind of person, she kind of judges Alice's profession and feels that it might be shallow for her to try to make everything look perfect. And that judgment, Alice can feel it, and that's part of their dynamic as well.
Yeah. They love each other, and they challenge each other.
Yes.
And I thought that the mother, Evelyn, I have the names right.
Yeah.
She starts really getting tough on Alice, and I mm-hmm. and so do you, by the way. I Alice has a hard row to hold.
She has a hard row. My poor husband read the book, and he's like, "Oh, bad things just keep happening to her, and she keeps making the wrong choices." And I was like, "Well, Dan, like, can you please name a story or a television show that you've enjoyed where it's just a happy day for all the characters involved?" This is how a story has to go.
I know. Yeah, poor Alice. Yeah. My heart goes out to her. If you write a follow-up, I want Alice in that story for sure. So Teddy is a nice, complicated mm-hmm. young boy, and you really write him beautifully. As a former young boy myself, a long time ago, how did you do that? I mean, you write about boys and men. It's not always easy.
No. I think one thing that my teaching career has done for me is kind of have a view into the teenage head. You know, like, I've been able to write kids, I think. And I love reading kids, but you can always tell when they're a little bit off. Mm-hmm. But I've spent so much time with them. I started teaching in 1999, and I've taught lots and lots of grade levels. So getting inside the middle school brain isn't too hard for me. What was really hard about Teddy was in the first few times I tried to write him the chapters that I shared with my writers group, they were like, "I don't get it. Is this kid a sociopath?" Mm. And I was like, no. He's just a normal kid. So I had to kind of figure out how to show his softer side or his the full range of his emotions and reactions to things. And that took a long time to get him.
Yeah, so let's talk more about Teddy. We have to talk about Teddy.
Yeah.
Well, Lionel Shriver.
I cut off my reading at the beginning because I didn't want to go on too long. But in that same conversation, his mom finds out the real reason that she's at the principal's office is that he has pantsed a kid on stage at school in front of the 500-person 7th grade class. And
Full pants.
And he says it was an accident. And I think he actually believes that it was an accident.
I do.
Yeah. I don't think he meant it.
That matters, Aunt. And he's laughing over
Thank
here.
You. Yeah. I appreciate that. And I think Teddy would appreciate that, too.
Yes.
But anyway, there's big consequences for that. And it's so public. And every parent in the whole 7th grade at school hears about it because mm-hmm. it's such a big event. So he had that going on. And he just feels desperately misunderstood. And then he gets betrayed by his friends, too, and kind of in the aftermath. He loses his phone for a while, and a lot of stuff goes down at school after this event, people taking sides, et cetera.
He's absolutely devastated by a friend, and it's just terrible.
And that's one thing this book is about, too. He's devastated by Sadie, the other girl that I mentioned, and I kind of wanted to explore this idea about friendships changing over time on both the adult level and the kid level. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people don't know what to do with friendships that dissolve. But I think it's okay to be friends for a while and then to grow apart and to leave that with okay feelings. And that happens to some adults in this book. But I think it's also happening to Teddy and Sadie. And in their case, it becomes very painful. But in middle school, that's a very normal occurrence that all of a sudden the kids you've played with in elementary school, we're going in different directions. We don't have to dislike each other, but how do you navigate that change from being like everyday best friends to just kind of people who know each other? Mm-hmm. It can be really hard.
And similarly hard for adults. Mm-hmm. Now, again, another nice thing here, we have this thing going on with the kids, and then we have this thing going on with adults, and mostly the women, mm-hmm. the mothers, who come and go in terms of their relationships. Intentional parallels there, or it just sort of happens?
No, intentional parallels. And I mean, this happens so often. I feel like I don't want to jinx myself or say the wrong thing by saying I'm on the tail end of parenting. I've got a 17-year-old, so he's going to be on his way to college next year. And I know I'm not done.
You're not, Kathleen. I have news for you.
I'm out of this particular phase.
Correct.
And what I've noticed is you do kind of get thrown together with people, like depending on who's on your kid's soccer team or who are the other hockey parents. And those people become people that you see all the time. And do you actually have anything in common? Mm-hmm. And the three women in this story meet each other at kindergarten roundup, and then they're just friends kind of by default. Mm-hmm. And then during the course of this story, this school year, that 7th grade year, I think at least two of them realize, like, we don't actually have that much in common. It would be okay for us to go our separate ways.
Wow. In my household, middle school should be abandoned completely.
well,
it should
I
be K through 8, 9 through 12.
Yeah. Oh, you should just go to a K through 8 school.
Well, of course. Oh, I could have done that.
Yeah.
Instead instead of complaining.
Yeah. Yeah,
but that's what I like to do. The way you wrote the novel, you chose to change point of view every chapter.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's not easy to do, to even think about doing if I were trying to write something like that. But it can be challenging for a reader, and I want to just full stop, let everyone know who's listening. It works. But I wasn't sure it would for me, because I'm often challenged by that.
Yeah.
So you pulled it off, and I think I know how you did it, but why'd you go this route?
Well, I kind of want to know how you think I did it, so that maybe I could do it again someday. But I'll tell you my inspiration. I am a huge fan of Leanne Moriarty, most famous from Big Little Lies. But and I thought about writing a novel for such a long time. And then finally, when I was 36, parallel with Alice, like my youngest son was in first grade, I felt like I was getting my life back a little bit.
Nice.
And I was like, well, if I want to write a novel, I better just try to write a novel. And right around that time, I started reading Leanne Moriarty. And I was like, oh my gosh, I love these books. They're so readable. You can read them on the beach or on the airplane, but they work on the sentence level and people would love to discuss them. So she was a real model for me, and she moves points of view in a similar way sometimes. So that was kind of where I got the idea. I wrote my first book in the same style, and then it really worked for me. And I like it. I like it because you can really get into the heads of each character.
And that's not it's a challenge for you, but
it is.
Yeah. Okay, so why I think it works
is
you keep this thing moving. The chapters are brief.
Yes.
It's really focused on the next action, and there's no scene that's wasted here. And yet, there's a lot of great writing, and if people listen closely while you were reading, contemporary America is in this novel, thick. References to everything on the kitchen shelves, to Harry Potter, and things that I don't know about anymore. Because the kids are doing them. So it really works. It works.
Thank you. I wish I could just tell you that it worked the very first time and it just flew off the pen just like that. But
no, I'm sure that's not true.
Not true. No.
Maybe
it takes me a long time to even understand like what the order of the events should be.
I see. Sure.
And who gets which chapter and an arc for each of the point of view characters. And I don't know. I don't know if there's such a thing as efficiency in writing, but if there is, I'm not the model of it.
We are talking to Kathleen West, author of the novel Are We There Yet? She is our very own Minneapolis writer. Yay!
Yay!
And you've mentioned your first novel a couple of times, so we're going to read it on air. We're going to mention the title, Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes. It's on my list, by the way.
Okay, good. That one is based on my time teaching at Edina High School, actually. So it's much more of a school novel.
Oh, wow.
And there's an English teacher main character who resembles me quite well, and then a helicopter theater mom.
Wow.
Who freaks out about the school's cast list.
Oh, okay. I love it.
Yeah, write that down.
You mentioned Sadie.
Yeah.
I was struck by her. She seemed really strong. I expected her to just collapse at some point and become a mess, and she doesn't. She's really got a backbone. Am I reading her right?
I think so. Sadie's mom is the one who cut her grapes until she was in second grade. Her mom, Alice has never heard of the portal, and Meredith, her mom, checks it three times a day.
Yeah,
like once in the morning, once to see how Homer Glowed's going to be, and then once, they're kind of opposite in their approaches. And Sadie is all the time trying to figure out like how to get what she wants in that hyper-controlled environment. But it's not like she hates her mom or dad. She doesn't. It's more like she's just trying to live her life around the structures that they have set up. And she makes some really major missteps that make her mom rethink the way that she's been doing things. But then there's a scene at the end maybe I shouldn't say too many spoilers, but this isn't really a spoiler. She has this great scene with her grandmother that I really enjoyed writing, where she talks about, she doesn't feel like with her parents that she can talk through her mistakes. She feels like mistakes are meant to be explained away or avoided completely or hidden and never spoken about. And with her grandmother, she confesses everything and kind of sees that she can still be loved in spite of it. And that's, I think, what changes her relationship with her mom.
That was a beautiful scene. And if I remember correctly, a surprising touch was the grandma really doesn't say anything. if at all. She's just there and present. And I thought that was a powerful choice on your part. Was that obvious to you?
You know, that was when I love it when this happens, and it happens so rarely, where I just have an inkling of where I should put the characters. Like in that case, they're washing dishes after Thanksgiving, and Sadie's helping her grandmother with the dishes. And then I don't really know what they're going to say, and then it happens. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's like one scene out of 40 that I write that happens like that, but that was one of them. And then I just have the grandmother kind of make eye contact with the mom who'd come into the room, and they both get to hear it together. So I didn't know that was going to be that way before I started writing it.
We've mentioned a number of characters. I wonder if it would be helpful to sort of explain this web and how they sort of play off each other and come together.
This book, it's really hard to give it like a one-line description, which is probably a marketing problem.
it's not a reading problem, folks.
No, it's
it's beautiful.
There's Alice and her family. So Alice is married to Patrick. Patrick is an attorney and travels a lot for business, and he's out of town doing a class action lawsuit. And so he's traveling during the week and home on the weekends. And of course, all this hits the fan when he's doing his traveling.
Yep.
And then Alice's mom is kind of part of that cluster of characters. And then I mentioned the mom has a secret daughter. So that's like Alice's family. And then there's Alice's friends that are the other group of characters, including Sadie and her mom. And then there's a kid, Donovan. He's not a point of view character, but his mom is Nadia. And Donovan is like the bad kid. Like he's been bad, quote unquote bad, since third grade, and serious behavior problems. He's been in therapy. And the other two moms always think like, well, Donovan's like that, or Nadia's that kind of mom. Mm-hmm. And then their own kids get in trouble. And so that kind of shakes that up too.
Yeah. We often talk about, I like to ask authors about craft and how they write, work, when they work, that kind of thing. We chatted a little bit about this before the show. But so you are a mom and a teacher and you're busy. And when do you write?
Well, my first novel I wrote from 4:45 to 6:15 a.m. I know. And I am an early to bed person, but I'm also an 8 hours of sleep per night person. So I couldn't really get the 8 hours of sleep when I was doing the 4:45 to 6:15. Mm-hmm. But that was the only time. And I really wanted to give it a try. So I did it then. And then after my first book sold, my publisher bought a second book as well, this book. So Minor Dramas sold, and they bought Are We There Yet? Before I had written it.
Sight unseen.
Yes.
Look at Kathleen West, ladies and gentlemen. We're applauding in the studio.
Thank you.
Woo!
Yeah. And I only had a year to write it, so I didn't think I could continue doing my teaching job at the level that I expect of myself. So I resigned my position at the end of the 2018-19 school year, and I didn't teach at all in 2019-2020.
Okay.
And that's when I really wrote this book. But during that year, I found that I really missed teaching, in fact.
Huh.
I think especially during the pandemic, because I realized that teaching is my coping mechanism. Like if you have to be the put together adult in the room, then you have to deal with the world. Like you can't stay in bed. Like you have to get out of bed and tell the kids everything's going to be okay. So, and that helps me. So I went back to work last fall, just for the fall semester. And now I'm teaching part-time. So I'm able to fit my writing in during the workday, although I still am an early, but more like 5:30 instead of 4:45.
That's more reasonable.
Yeah, more reasonable.
Any of your former students read your novels?
Yes. You know, that's so fun. I'm so old now that that some of my students are in their mid-30s.
Okay.
So when I first started teaching them, they were in middle school, and many of them have reached out on social media or sent me an email. And that means so much to me that they would take the time to read the books and reach out. And it's really fun to be a practicing writer and a teacher at the same time, because the lessons that I teach about writing just have a deeper layer of authenticity.
So you teach writing? You teach literature?
Yeah. This year I'm teaching 11th graders. And then I taught third grade most recently.
Wow.
So yes, I teach writing there. And then I taught middle school. I've taught a lot of different grade levels. But always, if I'm in secondary, I'm in English and social studies. Third grade, obviously, all the subjects.
Yeah. I fear we're running close here, and I'm going to get a notice quick. But look, there's a 2-minute warning. We have that in radio. Isn't that exciting?
I love it. Radio is the coolest.
So I want to talk about our next project before lose that time. So what are you doing?
Okay, I'm really pumped about... I was telling you before we started on air that I think my first book is great. I'm proud of it. My second book is better, right? I grew as a writer. Yep. And my third book is written also, and I think I grew again. So I'm very excited about that. And that one is easier to describe in a line, which is there are two women that both were contenders to make the 2002 Olympic hockey team.
Wow.
One makes it and one does not. And it's kind of about the aftermath of that. And 20 years later, when the one who didn't make it comes back to Minnesota with her hockey playing son and has to kind of walk back into the world that she abandoned.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. And this is already written?
It's written. It'll be out in March of 2022.
They should back that up about a month because Winter Olympics are.
I think that you should call my editor and tell her that.
I will.
Okay.
Give me her handles.
I will.
I need her handle. Is that right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you come back and visit us then?
Oh, I would love it. This has been so fun. And I didn't know that much about KFAI. I have learned all about it and I've had such a great time here. So
KFAI is community supported radio, right, guys? Yeah. Everyone on this on air and on the soundboard is a volunteer. We've been speaking with Kathleen West about her new novel, Are We There Yet? Give it a read, guys. And also the author of Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes, and we'll have her back next spring. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Great. And now this.
Hi, this is Liz, and tonight we are interviewing John Brandon, author of Ivory Coast. Welcome to Write on Radio. And why don't we start with a little discussion or a little piece of what the book is about, and then move right into your reading.
Okay, the main character is a 11-year-old boy, Gussie, and at the end of the Civil War, his mother passes away, and he goes on a journey to try to find his father. Just before she passes, she reveals to him who his father is. He never knew that before, and the father has no idea that he exists. So that kicks it off, and he's got to make it across the state of Florida from roughly Jacksonville to roughly Tampa on foot in this kind of post-Civil War, you know, landscape. And then many bad guys come around and give him some trouble, as they will. I was trying to think what to read. 3 to 5 minutes is short. My eye fell on this little passage that is when one of the villains, there are several, meets his end. And I thought, well, you shouldn't read that because that's one of the villains dying. And then I thought, you know what? I'm just going to read it. And I'm just going to call it a mini spoiler because there are other villains, worse villains. But, I'm a rebellious rule breaker, as you can tell. So this is, and maybe this is radio history. This big spoiler here. Should I just go ahead? And
go right ahead.
Okay. So what's going on here is the bounty hunter who's been tracking Gussie. They're coming up out of the swamps, and he's closing in. His name's August. He's closing in on Gussie, and it seems that they're getting kind of close to a town, a settlement. It seems like there's a farm nearby, and August is trying to get to Gussie and get him under control to take him back to Palmina where they started, before he can sort of get into the town. I think that's all you need to know. The boy grunted and wriggled, but August had him. He said there wasn't nothing for it now but to simmer down, and after a minute, Gussie seemed ready to accept this as fact. Both of them still breathed heavy. August hawked and spat over his shoulder. The boy went completely slack for a flicker of a second, but that was only in preparation to throw his head forward and sink his teeth into August's forearm. The elder combatant ripped away from his detainee, managing to keep him imprisoned with his other hand. The bite had barely broken skin, but August had had enough of the boy's stupid rebellion. He reached back and got hold of his pistol by the muzzle, yanked Gussie over face down, and took a short swing, the onyx gun butt resounding with a sick tunk against the little skull. The boy loosed a sharp cry that seemed to escape him before he could stop it. August wouldn't have minded one bit had the blow knocked Gussie out cold, but this did not happen. The boy squirmed all the more desperately, sobbing now. August was down an arm, hoisting the gun up and away so the boy didn't somehow get a hand on it, and Gussie managed to slip sideways and free an elbow and swipe it at August. The whole length of an arm followed, landing a hooking blow to August's shoulder that felt no more to the big man than a hearty greeting. "Tell you what," August said, "I'll just keep hitting you in the noggin. Before long, your brain will start working, or it'll give out once and for all." He took another quick stroke, whipping the crown of Gussie's head, and again the boy emitted a cry like a stomped rodent, and again he did not stop floundering or tossing his tiny fists. Snot was draining pale from his nose now, and his eyes were closed tight, oily remnants of the sardines shining on his lips. August felt an unexpected fatigue wash over him. He raised the pistol again, annoyed at being forced to do so. He gauged this blow, wanting to strike Gussie's head at the base, just above the neck, a spot he'd had luck with over the years when aiming to turn an ornery body into slack payload. He meant to deliver the boy alive, a disgrace to his professional prowess, to be sure, having to kill a 90-pound desperado in training in order to bring him in. August pressed his knee across the backs of the boy's legs and pinned Gussie face down again. Pistol overhead, he held his breath the way a sharpshooter might and convened his concentration to a single point, set his jaw and exhaled through his nose and drew upon a great share of his strength. And then, strangely, he did not see his arm fall before him as it should have. The weight of the weapon failed to flash downward and find its mark. His arm was still held high for some reason. The gun stuck up there like a weathercock. Something had gone awry with time itself. The minutes and seconds knotted in their own ropes. Time that made all debts due and overdue. Time that brought the dark forms of strange ships to the horizon. August was mindful all around him of an upbraiding clamor, a racket to fill all the wild pastures he'd ever crossed, the voice of his lord, if ever he'd had one. He was lying atop Gussie now, the boy struggling underneath him. August felt he was being drowned in a foot of water, held under in a warm, shallow cove. Fingers clawed at his hand, bending his thumb back, small and hard like a raccoon's paws, and August relinquished his grip and let the weapon be separated from him, knowing well what it meant to allow this. Gussie was beneath him still. It wasn't the boy who'd taken the gun. August could feel his hands, but not the arms that led to them. Could feel his heavy-booted feet down there somewhere, disconnected. The fingers that had claimed the gun tugged at his clothes, dragging at the meat of his shoulder, trying to roll him off the slithering boy. August could tell these little hands would not be able to move him, so he lurched his weight with a groan and the next moment felt Gussie slip away. The great hunter was on his back now. The fierce midday sunshine made it difficult to see the tree limbs not a rod above. Gun smoke hung on the air, as natural a smell as the wildflowers. August felt the need of a whole breath. His front was soaked and hot and his head chilled. He looked aside and saw Gussie there, his shirt painted in August's blood. And standing next to the boy, he saw an old woman in a collared dress and plain black shoes. He saw the long blue barrel of the old woman's shotgun, saw her hands, the raccoon fingers that had clawed at him. The weapon was over her shoulder, and August's pistol was in a big pocket on the front of her dress, the weight of the piece drawing her garment forward on her shoulders and exposing the tired, wrinkled flesh below her collarbones. August heard her tell the boy to sit down, but Gussie ignored the order. August could not stop looking at the woman, hair ash blonde, the skin of her cheeks as delicate as onion peels. He felt a need to touch her face. "We sistren of the South been compromised," she said, "but there's still doings we won't stand for." "Yes, ma'am," August said. He could see the woman in every detail. She wore dangling around her neck on a short silver chain a dried spider set in a walnut shell. The pearly buttons of her dress glinted like coquinas in the surf. And now came the breeze, first of the day, riffling her weightless hair. "Starting to wonder I'd ever get a rest," August said. "Think of something pleasing," the old woman told him. August saw himself as just another of the fallen logs. The weeds would grow up around him and swallow him to nothing with a kind of merciless love. He heard bird twitter in the air around him and the old woman's fingers tapping on her gunstock. The world was dimming, a colorless peace descending. His thoughts were of his mare, dozens of miles back the way he'd come, in the care of the kindly old man and his young woman. The oats and the fruit and the hour walks. He'd promised the animal, removing his hat and butting her affectionately with his forehead, that he'd return inside a week, a promise that would be broken. He saw his longtime companion waiting, waiting day after day, this only friend, this only one who'd ever put herself in peril to aid him, growing fat but discovering betrayal, a thing as yet unknown to her. August should have given instruction for if he didn't turn back up, but he had always turned back up, and he knew not, anyhow, what instruction he would have given.
That's John Brandon doing a reading from his book, Ivory Shoals, a very interesting book about the post-Civil War period and people, heroes and villains of the post-Civil War period. What inspired you to write about that period, and how did you move forward with that?
I should be able to answer that question probably better than I can. I'm always looking for a new landscape, a new set of details, new things for people to talk about. Detail and dialogue are kind of the things that I enjoy in fiction writing the most. I'd done Arkansas and New Mexico. When I went to those places, I just thought, okay, this will be a setting at some point, and used all those up. And I remember somewhere around the time, you're casting about for what's going to be the next sort of place to submerge yourself in. And I was casting about, and there was this book by Paget Powell that's, the whole thing is questions. Hmm. It's just 200 pages of questions kind of to the reader. And one of them was something like, does your alleged interest in the Civil War far outstrip your knowledge of it? And I thought to myself, I think he's talking about me. I feel like I'm interested in this, but I don't know anything about it. So, I started doing research, which I'd never done. I'd never written historical fiction. I'd never done research outside of, Googling something, 30 seconds here and there to make sure of something. And so, as you know, because you're a history buff, just to say I'm going to research the Civil War is way, way, way too vast. So I started reading about it and instantly knew I needed ways to narrow my field. And, Florida is where I'm from. I'm comfortable with it, but I'd never done historical. And it's an interesting place now, for better or for worse, but it's got a fascinating history as well. I found that if I narrowed it from Civil War to Civil War Florida, and then to kind of the end of the Civil War, that the search became manageable, and I had a couple really good librarians, help me in that task as well, and I wasn't really I wasn't looking like a real history buff would. I wasn't looking to know where did each battle take place and mm-hmm. how many on each side were lost. What are the important dates, and to know the ins and outs of every general. It wasn't like that. I was trying to get a feel for, you know, what it would have been like for these people just after this thing ended. And Florida was a great place for, because it's kind of off to the side of it. You know, it's not right in the kind of glamour spot of Virginia or something. You know, it's down there, and it's just like, okay, what's going to happen now? You know, and like Florida today, you know, it's opportunists show up and people thinking this will be a great place, and, you know, it's not as great as they think. So, yeah, I mean, when I started researching, it was just pulling out details that I thought, well, I could use that. And it was also just trying to get to a point where I kind of felt comfortable with, well, how do they cook? You know, what do they wear? Because, you know, until I can see the scene, it's just really hard to wade into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just feel unsteady, you know, until you feel like, okay, I can see this. So, yeah, I mean, my books, the upshot of doing all that research, which I did for about a year, at one point my wife was getting, you know, suspicious of how long I was carrying this out. Just telling you, you know, I started, the character smokes a pipe, so I started smoking a pipe. And, you know, she was like, you just want to read about the Civil War and smoke a pipe. You're going to do that forever. You're not going to write the book. What happened, though, was as opposed to my, normally when I write, I don't know everything that's going to happen. I just sort of have some problems. I present some problems to the characters and then kind of see what happens to them because of that. But there was no way for me to do all this research and pick out, okay, this is something I could use. This is something I use without asking myself, well, like, what for? What would you use that for? So I would start attaching different details and different little anecdotes that you come across mm-hmm. to different characters. And they kind of came alive, and then I could put them in different positions and a plot, you know, just sort of started happening. And then I found that, you know, I sort of had the blueprint for it. And then it was a matter of kind of event management and like villain management. I had too many bad guys, too many bad guys to go around. So like, how do I make all these bad guys fit in here? Yeah, I mean, it started that way. And normally, I think the thing that I kind of lost from that was when I would sit down to write, there wasn't as much discovery in it. So it was a little less exciting that way. But at the same time, I'd bitten off so much else with this. I was doing a whole different voice than I've ever done, this kind of little bit more formal, old-fashioned sort of voice, and then all, you know, just being in a different time and place, I had, you know, I guess enough to worry about without wondering where the thing was going.
I was going to ask you about voice. I found, I'm from the South, and I found the voice quite accurate and compelling, and what was nice was you didn't very much try to create the voice with writing out the accents of the people. You created the voice more with description and with, well, actually using words in your script or your thing that would be used rather than people. It was all in the dynamic part of the book, and I'm wondering how you discovered that voice. Did you already have it, or was it something you found in the middle of writing it? Or
no, I mean, I think that was the most time-consuming part of it in the beginning. I had a lot of false starts mm-hmm. with the voice. You know, I kind of knew the characters and knew what they were about, kind of knew it was going to happen. But yeah, I mean, the voice that I've used up until now that I sort of, you know, I figured out in my younger days, and then the first time it sort of I sort of had it was my first book, and then second, same, third, always that same voice. I think I was kind of tired of it. That was probably part of the appeal of this. But yeah, I mean, this the first say 50 pages or so. I mean, I don't know if it was 50, but I wrote over and over just getting the voice because I didn't. I still can't even say exactly what it is, but I wanted it to be more formal. So, okay, I had to go for that. But then I would try it, and it would just sound like an Englishman. You know? Okay, that's not quite it. And then I would, you know, try to make it Southern in whichever way I could, you know, without making it sort of a parody.
Right.
Or going like, okay, this is Cormac McCarthy. You know, so you know, it was like trying to modulate it until it was at least acceptable that I could go forward. You know, it sounded good enough that I could go forward. But then also, you know, once the book was with McSweeney's, my editor, you know, a lot of what we did was that sort of fine tuning on the word level of like what sounds right for this voice that we don't really know what it is. But once you hear it, you can kind of, you know what it's supposed to sound like. So, yeah.
Did you do a lot of out loud reading to yourself to try to see if it matched what you wanted it to be?
You know what? I'd like to say that I do that because I know it's really good.
Yeah.
And I suggest it to people, but I hardly ever do that. It's more just I hear it in my head, and I didn't know what I was going for, but when I finally got close enough, then it was okay. And I was excited to have a new voice, you know, to work in rather than the same old one.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the two characters and the end of the Civil War. Gussie is young, but he has to grow up really fast. And the women in the book, he's often saved from his adventures by women. And they have to, at post-Civil War, women had to kind of take over and do the stuff that's traditionally male, because all the men were gone. Like 75% of the male population of the South just disappeared. They all died in the war. And I'm wondering, you know, how you brought that across really well, that young boys had to grow up fast and women had to take over. How did you come upon that? Was it just something that you had in your mind, or did it come up when you were doing research, or how did that come to be?
Yeah, I think it probably reflects the research I did, just in that, you know, you can't read about that time without going like, oh, like these guys are gone, you know.
Right.
These guys are gone. So when, you know, when oftentimes when Gussie needs some help, that's who's going to be there. Is a woman. Who else is going to be there? So yeah, you know, I sort of had a thing to have fun with and deal with the men, which was like, so what kind of guys are still here, you know, that didn't go to the war for whatever reason? And that's a bunch of different types, you know, good, bad, and otherwise. But with the women, you know, it was more like, oh, they like have to do this now. They have to, I mean, and a lot, part of the way I was thinking of it is they also probably have to defend themselves and their place from these guys who didn't go to the war a lot of the time. So yeah, it just sort of worked and made sense to me that they would save Gussie when he needed saving.
Well, the boys and the women got very tough. They had to take care of themselves, you know, and so it was very well. I think the whole book was very accurate in terms of the characters and the voice. I must say, on the back of the book, and I'm sure you're not responsible for this plug, but it said that you were like Mark Twain and Cormac McCarthy, and that's heady praise. How did you feel about that?
Well,
that's a good
question.
I don't mean to put you on the spot there, but
I mean, it's one of those things where you're flattered to hear that. You hope there's some truth to it. But also, you know, that's what it says on every back of everybody's book, because the publisher wants to sell the book
right,
and the distributor
right.
wants to sell the book. So, you know, everybody's compared to some great
somebody, yes.
writer.
Everybody's
right.
compared to somebody. That sounds like a title of a song.
I can say that I couldn't sort of not think about Mark Twain writing it, just because it's episodic.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of moving across the countryside like that. And it was something I thought about, because, you know, Twain and lots of writers, they're so good at making each little stop its own story.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of grappling with, you know, not wanting to do that, because I wanted it to feel, I guess, more real than that. But also wanting it to feel like, well, we stopped here, so there's got to be something, you know, for the reader to take from this. Like, why do we stop here then?
You managed to do both. Actually, I think you managed to do both. Believe it or not, we are almost out of time here. So I want to just ask you, what's next? Do you have another project in line? And are you? I know you teach at Hamlin. What's happening with that? You know, what's next?
School year's about to start. So writing a little bit on the back burner, but, you know, teaching in the foreground and running around taking kids to sporting events every day of the week. I'm working on another novel. It's set in the 90s. It's kind of a little bit more straightforward crime deal. I'm in the middle of that, and, you know.
Police or detectives or
it's one of those things where it's a non-detective who's kind of forced to become a detective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Well, we've been talking with John Brandon, author of Ivory Shoals, and thank you so much for a wonderful interview. We've had a lot of fun here and laughed and spoiled and all that stuff.
That's right.
Who can beat that? Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Have a great evening.